Radio 3.
Join us for a mix of warming melodies and calming compositions, carefully curated to help you unwind.
So sit back, find a comfortable spot and escape with Night Tracks, Monday to Thursday nights from 11. Listen on Radio 3 and whenever you like on BBC Sounds.
It's midday, time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Louise Walsh worked in a second-hand bookshop in Glasgow before she took the plunge to become a writer, bursting onto the scene in 2002 with her prize-winning crime novel, The Cutting Room. As the author of seven novels and the Plague Times trilogy, she doesn't shy away from difficult subjects and unpalatable truths in her fiction, exploring issues of identity, sexuality, class, immigration, viral pandemics and shady economics. Her latest book, To the Dogs, is a thriller centred around a university professor who finds himself dragged into his former life of violence and danger when his son is arrested on drugs charges. But despite these serious themes, Louise's work is punctuated by a playful, sardonic sense of humour, highlighting the absurdity of certain situations. Oh, and a vivid vocabulary, slubberdegullions and tatterdemalions being two of my favourite examples from her first novel. What do they mean and how did you come by them, Louise?
It's almost in the word. It's almost onomatopoeic. A slubberdegullion is somebody who's rather slovenly and a tatterdemalion, somebody who's rather tattered, like a sort of ruffian. The painter James Pride paints these fantastic ruffians in tattered clothes and I think of them being like that.
You are Professor of Creative Writing at Glasgow University, and you love to collaborate because you've written short stories, plays, edited collections of poetry, and you have a long-standing working relationship with the composer Stuart McRae, with whom you've written four opera librettos. But we're going to hear music by Debussy, Purcell, Verdi, but first, a rousing piece of music. William Tell?
Oh, this is the first piece of classical music that I remember hearing. And we had the old LPs in the bottom of the record player, like many people who grew up in the 70s and the 80s did. And it was Johnny Cash, there was the Beatles, there was Nancy and Lee, and there was this. I think it was a double A side with the 1812 overture. And my sister and I loved William Tell, the William Tell overture. And we used to run around the sitting room, jumping over the furniture, jumping onto the armchairs and pretending that we were riding horses, because we also knew this as the theme tune to The Lone Ranger. And it was just the most exciting piece of music ever. And I think it introduced me to the just that visceral quality of music, that music can move us. It's not just something to be listened to politely. It's something to engage with and something to dance to and something to run to. And the blood moves faster.
Thank you.
And there go the springs of the sofa.
I want to clap and shout bravo as well. And I was conducting along. I think this is something that invites you to get involved. And I just imagine the orchestra all smiling and the audience all smiling. And I wonder what also appealed is that you hear the tiny instruments as well. You hear the piccolos and the triangles. And for little children, this idea that the tiniest thing can still be heard amongst the big, loud instruments as well.
The closing bars to the William Tell Overture by Rossini, performed by the Orchestra of the Academy of Santa Cecilia, conducted by Antonio Pappano. Can you remember some of the other pieces? You did mention 1812 when you were listening to that LP.
Oh, yes, because of course it has cannons. I was very excited by the idea that you could fire a cannon. And when I work with Stuart McRae, every project that we do, I say, could we possibly have a cannon? And Stuart so far has not given in, but I'm going to continue to ask because that's one of my heart's desires, to get to fire the cannon.
Was your early life, apart from jumping over the sofa, was it a happy childhood in Edinburgh?
Yeah, so we moved around a lot as a child. My dad was in the RAF, and like a lot of service people, I didn't realise it at the time, but in retrospect, I realised that we came back to Edinburgh, we were homeless, and despite being on the housing list and things. So we moved in with my grandma, who lived at Salveson Muir House, in the edge of train-spotting country in Edinburgh, and we lived with her in the war-wounded houses, because my granddad had been wounded in the war. And I loved living there. I think it must have been really hard for the adults because there were too many of us in one house. But I really adored it. And we weren't far from the sea and you could go down to the sea. And there was still that rural edge to the city, golf courses that you could walk over and find golf balls and horses that you could feed on your way down. So all of that I really enjoyed without thinking, gosh, my granny's sleeping in the sofa.
And was there music making in the house? Did you get to play an instrument at all?
Well, you know, I played the recorder at school, and I think my musical ambitions were thwarted when somebody hid it because I was truly awful. But always singing, a lot of rock and roll. I think Little Richard was my dad's favourite. My mum was really fond of Buddy Holly. And I think story songs as well. Country and Western's always been big in Scotland. I think for me, we did hear classical music on the radio, and I wouldn't know what this music was, but I always associated it with films, and I'd try and work out what kind of film was this and what might be happening. So I was always trying to impose a narrative on things that perhaps didn't have any narrative at all.
Well, your next piece actually looks forward to your creating opera because it's Rigoletto by Verdi. When I saw you'd chosen this, Louise, I suddenly thought, given the names you love and the words you love, that you must love Verdi's assassin and his name, Sparafucile.
It's a great name, isn't it? And this is such a great opera. And I came to opera through a series of films that were being shown on Channel 4 on the television. I was a complete novice. I knew nothing. So they showed La Traviata, Carmen, and they showed Rigoletto. And I came to this not knowing what happened next. And as I watched it, I was just horrified, I suppose, and excited as well. The strength of the storytelling just shone out.
Is there a particular moment you'd like to hear from the opera?
Yes, I want to hear the moment towards the end. Rigoletto has tried to avenge himself on the Duke of Mantua. Rigoletto is about to dispose of what he thinks is the body of the Duke, and he's very pleased with himself. He's managed to avenge himself and his daughter, and then suddenly, across the water from the land, he hears the Duke singing his drinking song, and oh no, he realises he's still alive, and in the sack is the body of his own daughter. And it's a moment of incredible drama.
Ma che importa, e ben adesso, e con i suoi stuori, ora mi guardo mondo, questo fuori, e non potente è questo, e sta sotto i miei piedi,
Stuff.
It's such a wonderful opera. It's a tragedy, and yet the pacing is rather similar to a farce. It's relentless, and the revelations are really nicely exposed. You know, this is an opera that's about curses, about natural justice, unnatural justice, and at the centre, the fact that there is no justice, and poor Gilda, as so often, unfortunately, in these operas, is the one who pays the price.
But isn't it amazing that in the middle of a rather sinister scene, he can put in an aria which has an bass?
Yes, and that asking us to hold two emotions at once, and I think that the tension between that, this very jolly da-da-da-da, and the awfulness of what Rigoletto realises he's done.
That was an excerpt from Act 3 of Verdi's Rigoletto, performed by the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra with the soprano Edita Gruberova, the tenor Luciano Pavarotti, and the baritone Ingvar Wicksell, conducted by Riccardo Chailly. Louise Walsh, did you have a talent for writing when you were young?
I enjoyed writing and I enjoyed reading. I think that's the most important thing. And as a child, I went to the library twice a week. My dad got us an adult ticket so that we didn't have to be confined to the children's books. But I did enjoy writing. And I think we came from a family of storytellers, and the ability to tell a story, the ability to make people laugh was highly prized. And so was I a good writer? I don't know, because I found some of my exercise books from when I was a child recently, and I didn't think they were that great, actually. So maybe it's just persistence.
After graduating, you set up a business, didn't you, selling second-hand books. Did that give you an insight into publishing, and indeed what kind of books were actually popular?
I think I was like a lot of actors that go and work in box offices or as ushers. I think I was trying to get closer and closer and closer to the books. So I'd worked in a second-hand clothes shop when I was at university. So I started to buy and sell books, and it wasn't a time of great employment. I think I learned that first novels often don't sell. So when I came to write my first novel, you know, I had very feet on the ground expectations.
But actually, any expectations you might have had were realised, weren't they? Because the first book that was published, The Cutting Room, in 2002, explored the dark underbelly of the antiques trade as the main character, Rilke, comes across some disturbing photographs at a house clearance. How did you come up with the idea for the novel? And was Rilke inspired by that wonderful poet?
Yes, he was inspired by the poet. I was thinking, of course, about Philip Marlowe, named after a poet, Edmund Campion, named after a poet. And I thought, I will name my detective after a poet. And I love Rilke. Also, the character that I made was a tall, thin man. And I think this is like a tall, thin word, if you look at it in certain ways. And I had been doing research without knowing it for years, because I'd been in the antique trade and going to auctions and observing people. And I guess I also wanted to explore something that wasn't doing what we were talking about with Gilda. I didn't want to have the naked female body tortured on the floor. I wanted something else. And so this investigation into photographs is almost about, is it true or is it not true? In the antiques trade and the book trade, you always have to think about provenance. You know, you have given me this book and told me that it's a first edition signed by Ian Fleming. When did Ian Fleming sign it? And how do I know that it's not just you that signed it? So those kinds of things. And it was a time of LGBTQ plus people. It was a very difficult time. It was a time when we still had Clause 28. We were trying to get that clause repealed, and there was a big, big fight to keep the clause. So as we went out, you know, around the city, we would see big adverts saying keep the clause, which meant queer people weren't allowed to teach in schools and all sorts of other restrictions. So this was a book that was set in that time. It never mentions the clause, but the clause is there, and that spectre of prejudice against LGBT plus people.
Rilke is a complex, secretive character, and I wonder how you developed this character.
I wrote a lot of short fiction, and I wrote short fiction that didn't work, basically. But what started to come together was the voice, and I had a really fantastic mentor, the South African novelist Zoe Wickham. And Zoe said to me, you know, I don't think you're a short story writer, you're a novelist. And I said, oh, no, I don't think so, Zoe. And she said, in her typical fashion, she said, oh, for goodness sake, Louise, just go home and start a novel and then bring me the beginning of it. And I brought her the beginning of it, and she said, good, now keep on with this.
The book is set in Glasgow, where you now live, and has wonderful descriptions of the city. One review has said that the city becomes a character in its own right, gothic, dismal, decaying and frightening, in equal measure. A city is very important to the next music, because it's from the film Taxi Driver, a wonderful score by Bernard Herrmann.
Yeah, this is an incredible piece of music, and it is that image of neon on wet pavements, isn't it? And I think the rise of the crime novel really engages with the city, and I think Bernard Herrmann really captures that tension between glamour, romance and danger in this music.
Thank you. It's a wonderfully sort of sultry, decadent, dirty sound, that saxophone, isn't it?
It is, and I miss the saxophone. I feel we need to bring back the saxophone. We don't hear it often enough now. There's such a beautiful sense of melody and foreboding there. And you're right, this grittiness. If I remember rightly, I think Martin Scorsese filmed this during a refuse strike in New York. So when you watch the actual film, the streets are absolutely filthy. And you feel you can hear that feeling of moving through the city at night in a taxi. You become a voyeur, don't you? You pass people, you pass buildings, and you see moments. You can almost make a story out of them as well. I think this movie does that so brilliantly.
We heard the theme from the 1976 Martin Scorsese film Taxi Driver, composed by Bernard Herrmann and arranged and conducted by David Bloom, with Ronnie Lang playing the aforementioned alto sax. The Cutting Room, Louise Walsh, won several awards, including the Saltire Society's first book award. 20 years later, you returned to the same character, Rilke, in another novel called The Second Cut. What made you want to write about him again?
Time had changed. When I first published The Cutting Room, I was really encouraged to write a sequel. And I just didn't have the urge. I didn't have it in me. And I knew that this book meant things to some people, and I just didn't want to ruin it. But 20 years later, you know, when it was no longer a really exciting commercial proposition, suddenly I could feel that the world had changed for LGBTQ plus people, the city had changed, and I just felt the itch again to return. And I wondered if I could do it as well. It was also that challenge. And I thought, I'll sit down, I'll read the first book, because of course you never read your own books. Why would you do that? And I made myself a pot of tea and I got the book, and then I just couldn't do it. And Rilke's voice was still there. And I made a decision. I made a decision not to age him. So time has changed, and somehow he has a consciousness of all that has happened. But I thought about Richmond Crompton's William Brown, who was forever, I think, 11 and three quarters. And I thought, I'm going to be inspired by that. My character will always be in his early 40s, which when I first wrote the book, I thought, gosh, that's quite old. And now, of course, I'm older than him.
Interesting, that thing about not really wanting to go back and reread earlier books. I think it's true with composers that one doesn't really want to play the early music because one's so living in the present and what one wants to do next. Is that the same with you?
Definitely. The book that you're writing is the one that you want to think about. And often, I don't know if this is also true of composers, the one that's ahead of that, because you've always got an idea for something else. And I guess while you're writing a piece, this could be the perfect piece. And then you finish it.
What I loved about the second book is that Rilke has a wonderful talent for describing people in a pithy way.
Humour is a very, very important part of crime writing, or any writing, I think, actually. I think it's a very hard book that doesn't at some point make somebody smile. But also, if we're working with dark themes, we need to have moments of lightness as well.
And I'm sure describing the weather is quite a big part of this, especially in Glasgow. It's the subject of your next choice, actually, a piece by Chris Watson. Tell us a little bit about this.
Yes, well, I don't know why I love this so much, because as you say, we have a lot of weather in Glasgow, and yet I love the work of Chris Watson. And he does these amazing field recordings that evoke the world, evoke nature, evoke place.
Lubbock is a range of remote mountains, isn't it?
Yes, and this is a recording that he did over a season. And he goes through the autumn and the winter, and he's in this highland glen. You just hear the change in the weather and the change in the season and the change in the wildlife as well.
Thank you.
It is immersive, isn't it? And no noise pollution. It puts pictures into my mind.
The opening of Lubbock from Chris Watson's 2003 album, Weather Report. Louise Walsh, you've written historical fiction set in Elizabethan London. Tamburlaine Must Die is a novella which imagines the last days of Christopher Marlowe's life in 1593.
Oh, yeah, Christopher Marlowe sallying forth into Tudor London. And how did he die? Because, of course, Marlowe's death is something that's really contested. Part of what fascinated me about Marlowe is he's living at a time when transgression results in painful torture and death, and yet he still transgresses. And I think there's a fascinating conundrum there, but also about performance. And Marlowe is one of the best writers in the English language, and that engagement with theatre and performance, which is a world that I really love. I've never been a performer, I've never been a director, but I have written for the stage, and I love that connection with the world of acting and performance and the transformation that one can make and the journey that it leads us all on.
We're going to return to the influence of the weather for the next piece, because it's the dialogue of the wind and the sea by Debussy from his La Mer. Did you know that Debussy, in order to experience what it might be like to be in a storm, took a boat into the English Channel in the middle of a terrible storm? He nearly drowned.
Gosh. I applaud him, because I would never do that. I guess, yeah, he didn't have a YouTube video to look at. But I guess Debussy is also going for the texture, isn't he? He's going for the, what does it actually feel like? And I love this piece of music. It's the first classical record that I bought myself, and I bought it in a second-hand record shop, and it was something that I'd listen to at night, you know, to help me calm down and get to sleep. When I hear this, I imagine, of course, Scottish seas. And to me, it's grey seas and steely skies.
Thank you. The third part of Debussy's La Mer, the dialogue of the wind and the waves, performed by the Los Angeles Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by Carlo Maria Giulini. You've written four librettos for opera with the composer Stuart McCrae, Louise Walsh. You began small, very sensibly, with a short opera, Remembrance Day.
Oh, this is one of the many joys of my life, is working with Stuart McCrae. We have had a fantastic apprenticeship, courtesy of Scottish Opera. They started us off when they commissioned 5 15-minute operas from writing and composing duos, and then they commissioned a second opera from us, a longer opera, Ghost Patrol, and then The Devil Inside, inspired by The Bottle Imp by Robert Louis Stevenson, and finally Anthropocene, which is our longest opera so far and is about to have a production in May in Salzburg, which we're hugely excited by.
This is set in the tundra of Greenland, isn't it, Anthropocene, where a team of scientists become trapped in the ice?
It is, yes. I think Stuart and I were both thinking about the mythology of Scotland and this idea about people being trapped, but also the idea of death and resurrection. And is resurrection a good thing sometimes? What we want most of all is for people that we love to return, but actually the return never bodes well.
Writing novels as you do is essentially a solitary thing, but when you're collaborating, you have somebody else to talk to and somebody else to bounce ideas off. Do you like that aspect of it?
I love it. Our process is always to talk. We sit in the National Library or the National Portrait Gallery in Scotland or each other's houses, and we drink tea and have soup, and then we walk around and we look at things and we talk about politics, about nature, and eventually we come up with a story. We both have to understand the characters and agree on their motivation, and then I go off and write little bits of libretto and Stuart sets it to music and we keep on going.
Well, what have you chosen for us from the opera?
So I've chosen a bit between our central character, Ice, who's been resurrected. She's been found mysteriously in the ice. The scientists think that they've found a frozen body, and then her eyes open. And this is, I think, a rather beautiful and touching moment between the ice girl and Professor Prentice, who is leading the expedition.
Ah!
Isis aria from Anthropocene, composed by Stuart McRae and with a libretto by my guest today, Louise Walsh, performed by the Orchestra of Scottish Opera with Jennifer France as Ice and Jenny Byrne as Professor Prentice, conducted by Stuart Stratford. I was fascinated by the way he suggested a frozen landscape by keeping the harmony fairly constant, but with bubbling textures and colours underneath it.
The texture of ice works its way through this opera, and the breaking of ice as well, because we thought a lot about Shackleton. The ship is stuck in the ice, and will they ever get away? And there's a moment when we hear the sound of the ice breaking as well. It's really thrilling for me, and it's thrilling to be involved in that world of opera. And I tremble with the excitement and fear.
And do you think in terms of phrases and vowels which would be nice to sing or sound mellifluous?
Absolutely. And this is something, of course, that I've learned, you know, that a very small word like no can take forever. Whereas a multi-syllable word can be fun and very, very fast.
One of the things you and Stuart have aimed to do, as you mentioned earlier, is to avoid the trope of the dying woman. Nevertheless, Dido's lament is about a departure.
It is, isn't it? So I've just completely contradicted myself. It's very beautiful, though. It can reduce you to tears and, you know, please remember me.
We heard Dido's Lament from Act 3 of Purcell's Dido and Aeneas, When I Am Laid in Earth, performed by the soprano Anna Prochaska and Il Giardino Armonico, conducted by Giovanni Antonini. The Plague Times trilogy was set against a contemporary deadly worldwide pandemic called the Sweats. It came out many years, actually, before the coronavirus, so it was very prescient.
Yes, but stories about plague have always been with us, of course. I think I started off thinking about Daniel Defoe and his History of the Plague Year. I'd always loved John Wyndham's novel since I was a child, and I was thinking about The Day of the Triffids, the horror and the question, what do we do if everything collapses? But when coronavirus came along, I was no better prepared than anybody else, really. I just did the same things. I went on my walk and I baked bread. And my plague, of course, goes much further than coronavirus did. There's no cure for this. But I was thinking really about economics as well. And the first volume starts off almost with a love letter to the NHS, you know, and a cry against Big Pharma. We shouldn't be profiting from ill health.
Your latest book, which I'm enjoying at the moment, To the Dogs, is set on a university campus. So what made you want to set the drama there?
Well, you know, the campus novel also has a great and long history, doesn't it? And it's a very elastic form. I'm Professor of Creative Writing at the University of Glasgow, which is one of the other joys of my life. Of course, you write about what you see, although I have to say I haven't seen any of my colleagues dispatching each other. But also my professor in this book, he's arrived, he's doing fantastically well. But at the same time, a lot of the gates that allowed him to enter higher education are closing. And I suppose that idea is also present.
Sadly, we're getting to the end of this particular semester. So tell me about your final piece, which we're going to play out on Louise Walsh.
Oh, it's just the most beautiful piece, The Light of Air, by an Icelandic composer, Anna Thorvaldsdóttir. It consists of four movements: luminescence, serenity, existence, and remembrance. And I love the texture of this composition, and I like that it's not a straightforward melody. It makes me listen, and again, it makes me respond with my body, and there's an element of weather there, which you already know I love.
Well, it's lovely to have two pieces by living composers today, Louise, for which I thank you, and thank you very much too for bringing the whole programme.
Well, thank you so much, Michael. I've loved it.
Existence from In the Light of Air by the Icelandic composer Anna Thorvaldsdottir, performed by the International Contemporary Ensemble. That was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest today on Private Passions, the writer Louise Welsh. The programme was produced by Claire Walker. Next week, Michael will be talking to the chef, Raymond Blanc. BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM, digital radio, BBC Sounds, and on your smart speaker. It's just coming up to 1 o'clock. Time for the news, read by me, Jane Royce. The Foreign Secretary, Lord Cameron, has warned Iran that it will be held accountable for its proxies as another round of American and British airstrikes took place in Yemen. The military action was designed to deter further attacks on merchant shipping in the Red Sea. The Iranian-backed Houthis, who control much of the country, have promised a response to the strikes. The Royal Navy says the aircraft carrier HMS Queen Elizabeth will not be joining the NATO exercise she was due to lead. Officials say it's because of an issue with the vessel's propeller shaft, which was spotted during final checks. Her sister ship, HMS Prince of Wales, will now lead the exercise, which is the largest since the end of the Cold War. The Metropolitan Police are offering a reward of up to £20,000 for information that leads to the arrest of a man suspected of attacking a woman with a corrosive substance in London. Abdul Shakur Azedi was last seen at Tower Hill Station hours after the attack on Wednesday night. A woman known to him suffered injuries thought to be life-changing. The mother of Brianna Jai, the 16-year-old who was murdered by two teenagers, has said she does not hold any hate for her daughter's killers. Scarlett Jenkinson and Eddie Ratcliffe were given life sentences last week for Brianna's murder. A woman has died after being attacked by two dogs in Essex. She was found seriously injured in Jaywick near Clacton yesterday evening. The dogs have been destroyed, but their breed has not yet been confirmed. A 39-year-old man has been arrested. The Education Secretary, Gillian Keegan, has said she's very confident that the government will be able to keep its pledge to expand free childcare in England later this year. Concerns have been raised that the system won't be able to cope with the additional demand for places. The President of Chile, Gabriel Boric, has said he would make all necessary resources available to tackle the wild forest fires that have killed more than 50 people. At least 1,000 homes have been destroyed in the Valparaiso region. It's believed to be Chile's deadliest forest fire on record. Cricket and England have ended the third day of the second test against India in Visakhapatnam on 67 for one. Despite giving up a first innings deficit of 143, England clung on and now need 332 more runs to win. The weather, cloudy, windy and mild for most areas, while the west of Scotland, northwest of England and parts of Northern Ireland will see some persistent rain. Stronger winds tonight, especially across northern parts of the UK. And that's the BBC News and weather. It's 2 minutes past one.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music. There's a lush romantic evening ahead with Mahler's heavenly Fourth Symphony and a captivating song cycle from Berlioz. Explorations of love and nature with the Philharmonia and soprano Anne O'Comsey. Radio 3 in concert, Berlioz and